You're listening to a Big Finish production.
Doctor Who, Short Trips, The Authentic Experience. Written by Dan Starkey, read by Nicola Bryant. Perry strokes the stubble on his jawline with a calloused thumb and looks out across the snowy waste before him. The sky has no colour, and the horizon is indistinct. He watches his breath freeze in front of him and then fade. The butt of his rifle chinks against the brass buttons of his greatcoat as he resumes his march. The other members of his platoon spare few words. Olaf and Sigurd are from the same village, and so share something in common to talk about. But the rest of them are like Perry. Irregulars, crawling across the icy wastes, fighting skirmishes in a war none of them can remember the reason for. Something to do with Fat King Gustav or one of his subordinate princelings. They laugh at Perry sometimes. The way the tears well up in his eyes every time he squeezes the trigger. The way he pauses in thought at pointless details on their march. A frozen leaf. The shape of a snow-draped tree in the distance. Words form on his lips, involuntarily. Salix, Macinites, Picea Abies. Latin? What is he? A priest? A doctor? He doesn't look like one with his heavy brow and broken teeth. He is a man apart. He trudges in the melting footsteps of the platoon, their dark coats blanched by the white expanse ahead, and the wind chills his bones. 10, 12 men crawling across the landscape like flies across a piece of blotting paper. Tiny dots in the emptiness. Perry's heels clanked along the gunmetal balcony on which the TARDIS had materialized, and she stopped to look down at the concourse of the spaceport below. Hordes of commuters swarmed from one transmat station to the other, some breaking away from the crowd and dashing in neurotic shoals, others trudging with a more unenthused, fatalistic air. Fast and bustling, it reminded her of being back in New York, of Grand Central Station at rush hour, but with significantly less grandeur. The overall tone of the place was grey. Grey suits and grey faces, grey directions in grey writing on grey signs, all illuminated by a filtered light that managed to be grey in its partiality. In their bright colours, she and the doctor seemed rather overdressed. But of course, that was nothing new for the doctor.
"This doesn't look like a very happy place, doctor," she observed.
"Functional, I agree. This planet's a business and trading hub for this part of the galaxy, sometime rather far in your race's future. Most actual commerce and finance is managed by computers in this period."
"Then where are all these guys going in such a rush?"
"Oh, your species does still like to seal the deal, face to face when they can, despite telecommunications, or face to prehensile eye stalk, depending on the clientele. Now,"
he squinted at a flashing device attached to his waistcoat pocket by a vulgar green chain.
"The source of the temporal fluctuations seem to be down there."
He pointed towards a parade of shops, tucked into one of the spaceport's dingy arcades. Perry looked at the illuminated dial in the doctor's hand and... Olaf smiles wolfishly, dangling the watch in front of him. It gleams silver in the pale winter sunlight.
"See this? Most expensive thing I own. Engraved and everything. Can't read it, but who cares? Didn't bring any luck to the fella I took it off."
He sees the disapproval in Perry's eyes and snorts.
What? You never taken a souvenir off the battlefield?
He didn't need it anymore, did he? He raises it to his ear, and his eyes shine with childlike glee as he listens to its faint tick.
I could buy a field with this when I get back home.
If you get back home, says Perry grimly.
You know something I don't?
Perry shrugs.
Then shut your mouth! At least I've got a home. Where are you from?
Perry has no answer. Olaf sniffs, then wraps the watch up in a rag, his stubby fingers moving with unusual delicacy. He stuffs it into the inside pocket of his uniform. There is a silence between them. Olaf looks into the whiteness and stamps his feet, and a thought occurs to him.
That watch is worth more than your life or mine, he warns. So best you keep it to yourself. You understand?
He flashes Perry another lupine smile.
You won't believe how cheap it is!
The woman smirked with pursed magenta lips and flicked her asymmetrical bob as she gestured to the beige facade behind her.
Although we boast the authentic experience, rest assured that we take the highest care to preserve the safety of our clients.
So, tell me, Miss Ebo, the doctor began.
Amy, please!
The woman snapped, about to resume her spiel.
This technology you're using, where did you get it?
Ah, commercial confidentiality prohibits me from answering that question, Mr...
Doctor.
Doctor!
She raised an eyebrow.
Well, well, I can see you're dressed for a holiday, both of you.
She cast a somewhat supercilious eye at Perry before continuing.
But you should know that you can enjoy nearly a lifetime's worth of experiences in less than one work cycle. Time is no object, and we are proud to offer economy and quality.
The doctor raised an eyebrow now.
Time is certainly no object. It's far more complicated than that.
A blank stare.
Well, on the technical side, our engineer's taking his lunch break at the moment, but we can carry out the preliminaries if you'd like to follow me.
Amy Ebo waved her hand airily and sauntered into the travel agency. The doctor and Perry shared a quick glance before following her.
Perry reels back from a rifle butt to the jaw, and he tastes blood in his mouth. His opponent lurches forward, overbalancing and slipping on the ice underfoot. Perry springs onto him and they struggle, raining blows on each other. Red speckles the white snow. The platoon is engaged in a violent skirmish. There are shots and gunfire, the sounds of dying muffled by the snowstorm that rages around them. Perry struggles to his feet, one eye half closed with the pummeling he sustained from the other man's fists. He manages to pull a pistol from his belt, a souvenir of his own, and without another thought squeezes the trigger. His assailant jerks as the bullet strikes him full in the chest. His limbs contort and thrash. Then a stillness passes over him. The tears that his comrades have mocked him for sting Perry's eyes again as he crawls across the snow to look at the dying man.
I'm sorry, he croaks. You need a doctor.
He surprises himself with the inanity of the consolation he tries to offer, and finds himself holding the dying man's hand. His fingers shake and he feels faint. His former enemy, however, remains curiously unmoved. He looks down at his bloodied chest with a frown that looks more indignant than outraged.
It's not my time yet,
he mutters with a distinctly petulant tone. Then his eyes close and his body stiffens. Perry begins to sob.
Oi, Perry, behind you!
Anders calls from somewhere in the snowstorm. Perry throws the man's hand aside, whirls around and narrowly escapes the razor tip of a bayonet slicing towards his neck. He scrambles to his feet and draws his sword. As he thrusts and parries, he glimpses behind him. The soldier's body has already disappeared in the snow. Can the blizzard be that strong?
The tourists lay in transparent caskets like sarcophagi around the edge of the stasis chamber. In the centre of the room, a control panel dotted with lights winked regularly.
"And this is the stasis chamber itself," announced Amy Ebo with a flourish.
The doctor strode into the centre of the room and prodded the control desk with obvious distaste.
"A chronotopic projector? I haven't seen... This is Luconian, isn't it? Where did you find it?"
For the first time, Ms. Ebo's air of polite condescension was disturbed.
Best if you don't touch that, Doctor. It's a very sensitive piece of equipment."
"A Luconian temporal manipulator. I thought they all disappeared along with their creators."
"It's actually a property of Exurus Holdings PLC, our parent company, and I'd be grateful if you stepped away from it."
Ms. Ebo's polite manner was becoming increasingly strained.
"Who are the Luconians?"
asked Perry, looking into the empty stasis booth.
"Were the Luconians? Insectoid chaps, all bling and antennae.
For such a technologically advanced race, they weren't all that bright in the end." Ms. Ebo folded her arms.
"Well, Doctor, I have considerable experience in tourism in this sector of the galaxy, and I've never heard of them. As I have mentioned, this is private property. I'm getting the impression that you're not actually looking for a holiday." "A holiday?"
The doctor was appalled.
"You won't have heard of the Luconians because they never existed. Not in your timeline, anyway."
Ms. Ebo laughed derisively.
"We don't do trips to Crazy Town, I'm afraid."
"They carried out unlicensed experiments in time travel using chronotopic projectors just like this." He indicated the control panel.
"And managed to erase themselves from history. I'm amazed that this bucket of bolts survived. It's a working paradox. Do you have any idea how dangerous it is?"
Ms. Ebo's hands moved to her hips.
"Look, before you start making accusations, this facility has a 100% safety record. All our tourists have a comprehensive induction and sign a disclaimer before starting their temporal adventures. And all for the fraction of the cost of a resort planet, I might add."
"Your business acumen is not matched by your grasp of temporal physics, Ms. Ebo. Where, or rather when, are these tourists going?"
"Ye olde Earth, back in the day. Far too long ago to make any difference. It's all quite legal. I've got the paperwork."
The doctor gave up listening to her and returned to the control panel.
"It's no good. I'm going to have to shut this all down."
"Your what?"
All trace of politeness had gone, and Ms. Ebo moved with some urgency towards the doctor. Perry saw that there was a situation to defuse, and she moved to intercept the woman before she could interfere with the doctor.
"Hey, I'm sure we can all talk about this, Doctor."
She tried to lay a reassuring hand on Ms. Ebo's shoulder, but the taller woman gave her an aggressive shove out of the way. Perry stumbled backwards and fell into the open stasis booth, which shut with a sharp click. The machine whirred into life around her, and a debilitating numbness washed over her. She was dimly aware of the doctor pushing past the now panicking travel agent and staring at her with concern through the transparent cover of her booth. Then her vision bleached to a featureless, brilliant white. The night is still and clear. The stars shine bright above the snow-draped land. But Perry has no mind for them. He's been staring into the campfire for the past quarter of an hour. It had been hard to get the snow-dampened pine logs to take light, but now they blazed well, making Perry's face throb with heat, despite the chill of the night air. The surviving members of the platoon lie around the fire, sleeping after the day's march, and from burying three of their comrades at the site of the skirmish. It is Perry's turn to keep watch, which is fine. His bruised eye makes it hard to get comfortable
or as comfortable as one can get on this rocky escarpment overlooking the valley. Perry's good eye is absorbed by the fire. He sees shapes within it. Little orange suns are born, glimmer and die. Nebulae blossom in the depths. Nebulae? That's an odd word. Neb-u-lie. Sparks fly up into the night, like sprites, like rockets, like starships. A starship? Some sailors navigate using the stars, it's true, as well as their charts and lodestones, but Perry's never travelled in one, as far as he can remember. Then why does he feel like he's so far from home? And where is home, anyway? Where? In the heart of the fire, a tree stump cracks abruptly, and it's as though a voice echoes in Perry's mind. It seems to call his name. Or is it the wind? Again the fire crackles and words drift into his consciousness. The fatigue makes his body sag, and he leans closer. Insensible of their heat, he reaches into the flames as he hears his voice called a third time.
Perry!
Olaf has grabbed him by the shoulder and is dousing his burning coat sleeve with snow. Perry blinks in the light of the early dawn as Olaf berates him for nodding off in front of the campfire. Dumbly, he looks at the burns on his hand and keeps it buried in the snowdrift until the platoon starts marching again. Words are said to him, words from his comrades, from Olaf and the others, but he doesn't hear any of them. Although he marches only a few steps behind them, they could be half a world away. They are by the side of a frozen river. The ice is thick enough, but the men don't trust it. They march on ahead, but Perry dawdles, nursing his burnt hand.
Perry! Perry!
The voice carries across the wind. The same voice from the fire the night before. Perry looks out at the centre of the frozen river and feels a quickening in himself.
Perry! Follow my voice!
More urgent now, the voice guides him out beyond the riverbank, out onto the frozen surface of the river. The other soldiers in the platoon are calling after him, telling him to stop being a fool. But he doesn't hear them. He needs to follow the voice.
That's it, Perry. Now, let's see.
The ice cracks under his heavy boots, and he falls through into the freezing waters below. Perrault whips his hand out of the ice bucket and grins in embarrassment at his fellow passengers. The waxed bristles of his moustache twitch in the strong headwind.
Not to worry, monsieur. There's enough champagne for all of us,
chortles the professor from the other side of the basket. He twists a valve and a burst of flaming gas roars up into the balloon above them. Sparks fly up into the night sky. Perrault looks behind him at the vast blue sky and the snowy mountaintops below them, and his senses reel for a moment. Of course! He's on a balloon expedition, along with the professor, Lady Letitia Fanshawe, Otto Graf von Altdorf, and Mr. Jeffreys, the financier. They've just crossed over the French Alps into Switzerland, as it's been planned for months. So why does he feel so out of place? The Graf adjusts his monocle, his one good eye, and squints at the other passengers.
I think that our French friend is missing his beloved France too much so eagerly for the champagne to reach.
Polite chuckles under the roar of the gas burners. Despite the German's teasing, Perrault's eye is drawn once again to the ice bucket. Not to the bottle within, but the silver plate outside it, which gleams in the sun. Is there something there?
Perry!
Perrault is startled to see a face reflected in the polished bucket. Startled that the face is not his own, but is strangely familiar nonetheless.
The doctor leaned over the control console and thumped the protesting system.
Perry!
He shouted into a glitching comms panel. He could just about see where and when Perry had been flung by the projector, but how to explain the experience she was undergoing with such a limited communication setup was quite another thing. Amy Ebo was also darting around in the background, haranguing him, but she was running out of threats.
Your friend is perfectly safe, which is more than I can say for you when my engineer gets here. And you might like to know that I've contacted the police as well, so I strongly advise you to step away from that machine.
I have a far more nuanced grasp of this device's mechanics than one of your functionaries possibly could, said the doctor as he punched the controls. Now, your Taurus bodies remain in this time and place, but their consciousnesses are projected into the past as physical avatars of some kind, yes?
I'm not tech, I'm sales. And if you don't get off that equipment, I'm going to have to get heavy with you.
I'd like to see you try, the doctor said wryly before continuing with his thoughts.
Now, the avatar is projected into the past, cushioned within a synthetic time stream concocted by this horrible thing.
He tapped a bulky unit protruding from one of the control panel's faces.
Like cutting and pasting someone's picture into an old photograph using blunt scissors and poisonous glue.
Amy Ebo looked indignant, but the doctor was in full flow.
And I presume this set of controls... The doctor tapped another bank of lights, adjusts the gain, as it were, allowing one to calibrate the degree to which the traveller physically intrudes into the real world. Their sense of taste and touch and so forth, yes? This controls mass.
He experimented with a slider, turning it upwards. The machine protested with a whine.
The power needed must be astronomical.
He looked closer and snorted.
Oh, I see. You've got all these settings so low that most of them can't even feel pain.
Very sensible.
Trade secrets,
snapped Amy Ebo.
So much for your authentic experience, muttered the doctor, and bent back over the comms panel.
Perry, I don't know if you can hear me properly, but you've been thrown into the past. I'm trying to get you back, but I can't shut the system down until we get everyone else out with you.
His hands darted nimbly over the system in his attempts to ascertain Perry's location in time and space. Amy Ebo shrieked in frustration and rushed out of the stasis chamber. She couldn't just pull the doctor away from the controls without endangering the rest of her clients, and she was still partially liable despite the small print on the agreements they'd all signed.
If only the company would pay Cyril the engineer for a full work cycle, not cut on costs by only giving him shifts. At least the police were coming soon. But desperate times called for desperate measures.
Perrault looks at the face mouthing at him in the side of the ice bucket and hears a voice echoing around his head.
Now... Is there anyone who looks out of place where you are? You need to take them with you when I pull you out of the interrupted time stream. I've set it to detect the time differential released when you make physical contact with them.
The words are strange. But Perrault trusts them. His train of thoughts is interrupted by a sigh of frustration from the professor.
They're still losing height,
he moans as he fumbles with the valves running to the burner, keeping the balloon afloat.
I don't understand it. I made all the necessary calculations for a group of this size and weight.
Lady Fanshawe bristles at this, and the Graf glares through his monocle on her behalf. The financier, Mr. Jeffries, looks at his feet and shifts uncomfortably. Perrault gets an inkling that he might be the one out of place. By now, the professor is dropping sandbags from the basket, and the balloon is starting to lurch in the air. The mountains look considerably closer than they did a few minutes ago.
It's no good, the professor yells. We're going to crash!
The basket shakes violently. Perrault decides to take action and shifts his weight towards Mr. Jeffries. Jeffries looks up at him, confused.
What's happening?
He asks helplessly. But Poirot accosts him by the shoulder. He feels a strange connection with the other man, an almost electric sensation as his fingers touch the man's silk lapels. The basket, the mountains, and the balloon fade away into the distance, as a great tugging sensation lifts them both upwards and into a great white nothingness. The last thing Poirot can hear is the echo of the professor's voice far in the distance.
Very impulsive, these Gallic types.
With a gasp, the amazing Perpergillium completes a full somersault and lands on the arcing trapeze. She grasps the rope with a chalk-dusted hand and flexes the balls of her feet as she regains her balance. She squints in the spotlight and feels the tautness in her sinews, every muscle of her body trained to give the appearance of effortless grace as she spirals in the darkness. She looks down past her feet, shod in silk sandals, past her sequined body, and glimpses the sand of the circus ring very far below. She manages to turn her silent scream into a dazzling smile. Her heart thumps and the crowd roars below. She's momentarily surprised by the fact that she appears to be female again and thanks heaven for small mercies. On the platform opposite her are five other figures. Four men with extravagant moustaches and another woman dressed similarly to herself. They shine in bright peacock blue against the dark, billowing expanse of the big top. Perpergillium squints, and it occurs to her that the platform opposite seems strangely crowded with all the acrobats' bodies. How many of them are there? And which one is the interloper? One of the men, statuesque with jet-black, brilliantined hair, beckons her towards him. And an instinct kicks into her body with a surpassing vigour. She launches her body weight forwards and sets her trapeze in motion. Despite the panic in her mind, she expertly sits down, loops her leg around the swing and arches her body, holding out her arms ready to catch the next acrobat that flies her way. How? Surely she's not strong enough. The woman opposite her, Celeste, is that her name? Is dangling from her trapeze by now, swinging like a pendulum in time to the rocking of Perpergillium's own. They look at each other across the darkness, their very breaths synchronising in anticipation of the leap that the woman will make into Perpergillium's outstretched arms. Then, as Celeste lets go and flies towards Perpergillium's outstretched hands, one of the men launches himself across Celeste's flight path on another trapeze. His movements are wild and jerky, and he has a mad grin on his face. Celeste is a few beats ahead of him, but her rhythm interrupted. Celeste flails towards Perpergillium. She snatches with one hand, and Perpergillium gasps as her left side is wrenched, taking Celeste's entire body weight in one hand. The audience gasp. They spiral wildly, dangling off the trapeze. As Perpergillium strains to keep hold, the chalk on her hand sustaining her grip, despite the perspiration that soaks her palm. With gritted teeth, she regains her balance and tightens her grip on Celeste. Together, they swing. And Celeste is able to use the momentum to flip herself up onto the trapeze, standing on the bar that Perpergillium dangles from. On the other side of the big top, the rogue acrobat just swings, grinning at them idiotically. Perpergillium resolves to teach him that his actions have consequences. She starts to swing again, using Celeste's weight to increase her momentum. She stretches up, grips the bar beneath Celeste's feet, and unhooks her legs from the sides of the trapeze. At the height of the swing, she lets go of the bar, somersaults through the air to even louder gasps from the crowd below, and barrels into the man on the trapeze opposite.
His grin turns into a perfect O of surprise as she catches him in something approaching a mid-air rugby tackle. She feels a strange crackle, like an electric current, as she makes contact, and entwined they tumble towards the sand of the ring far below. A red light flashed on the control panel as the doctor worked feverishly launching Perry from time zone to time zone.
"Good work, Perry," he breathed
as he saw another booth hum into life. The temporal torus were starting to stir as their consciousnesses returned to their bodies.
"Don't think I want you roaming about in the real world just yet, though."
He twisted a control, and the revived torus slipped back into a gentle slumber.
"Some rude awakenings in store later on, though," he mused.
Perry's consciousness was still in freefall, tumbling through the ages, and the doctor was grateful for the narrow temporal and geographical spread of the torus they had located so far. 19th century Europe did seem surprisingly popular, although this might have had something to do with the limitations of the engineer, as well as Ms. Ebo's imagination. Gently, he coaxed the controls and projected Perry elsewhere and elsewhen in the time streams to waken the occupants of the remaining sarcophagi. She gasps as the whalebones of a corset cinch in her waist and turns her wrist in a demure wave at the well-to-do passengers of a gondola on the far side of the canal. She walks slowly, looking at her reflection. Tall, pale and interesting in the brackish water. The sulphurous stench of the sewers offends her in its acridity, and she raises her pomander to her nose. Some way down the balcony, so many grey-faced people rushing to transmat stations. A broad-shouldered young man stands with his back to her.
"Oh, help me, Hans,"
she whispers in her breathiest of tones. He turns his impressively maned head, and his eyebrows raise in surprise as she swoons theatrically. He catches her in his arms, and there is an immediate tingle that runs between them. She looks up at him and whispers,
"I'm afraid your grand tour is over now."
The canal and all the rest of Venice fades off into the ether. The cedar shaft of the fishing net nestles beneath her thumb, its green flax basket trailing lazy arcs in front of her knees. She wades through warm, shallow waters of a startling blue. Beneath, there is a dart of silver, the flash of a dorsal fin breaking the surface only momentarily. She twists her wrists, and the fish is wriggling in the air, helpless in the net. Bringing it closer to her face, she looks at the fish, gasping in the blazing sunshine, a rainbow glittering within its scales like burnished steel. Steel? Odd thought in this time of flint and bone. She sees the fish's gills open and close, and her lips part in a rueful smile. Time's up. The fish's eye looks back in glassy accusation as she tickles its belly with a gentle finger. The azure expanse of the ocean recedes from her and her head bows under enormous pressure. There is a scent of controlled panic in the stuffy air. She is constrained, bolted into place. The ground shakes, the walls shake, everything trembles, and she finds herself panting as the force pushes down on her. She is staring at the floor in a tiny, cramped space, and she feels very different. She tries to call for help, but all that comes out of her mouth is an inarticulate howl. She thinks she's about to black out in the heat when there is a jolt and a sudden feeling of release. Her head no longer forced towards the floor, she stretches out the vertebrae of her neck and barks happily. Barks? She looks around herself at the tiny chamber and notices for the first time that she's not alone. there are two dogs in crude canvas pressure suits either side of her. She must be... She's a dog too! Fragments of this life filter into her mind. She experiences a dreamlike feeling of weightlessness as the capsule she's in parachutes down to Earth through the upper atmosphere. Does she have a name here?
Yes. Pushinka. Bit of fluff in Russian.
How dignified.
She looks again at her co-passengers. The one to her left seems calm, trained. He pants at her happily, and his eyes shine in contentment.
To her right, however, it's a different story, and the dog's brindle face is contorted.
He whines, and she can feel his discomfort.
She cranes her neck and nudges his muzzle with her nose.
Their eyes meet, and after a spark of realization, the shuttle continues its descent to Earth, unburdened of its two extra passengers.
Astonishing, the doctor said to himself, spooling through the last tourist details on the display screen. The poor fellow wanted to experience being an astronaut, and he ends up being a dog in a tin can. Poor data entry as well as poor temporal engineering.
Another booth hummed into life behind him, and he subdued its occupant into a comfortable sleep.
Now, Perry, he said, leaning into the comms panel. We've got all these tourists back safely, but there's one last thing I need you to do before I bring you back. I don't know if you'll quite understand what's going on, but trust me.
He punched a complex series of commands into the control panel as he projected Perry into the past one last time. He was so intent on his task that he failed to notice Ms. Ebo coming through the door behind him. She had a determined scowl on her face and carried a chunky phase pistol.
Perry moves faster than thought, diving and twirling in patterns that last a tiny fragment of a second. The loops she traces are infinitesimally smaller than the arcs of her trapeze. She is a flurry of data, a stream of quantum bits in permanent flux, like snowflakes in a blizzard whirling through some microscopically narrow mountain pass. She leaps between gaps, closes gates behind her, opens doors where none had previously stood. She seems to exist in multiple places at the same time. She darts like a fish, but she has no body, barely any physical being at all, only a purpose. A purpose that impels her forward at a speed that challenges light itself. Sparks fly up into the night sky. She ties the final threads of her slipstream together, and then she feels herself slow. A whiteness bleaches her consciousness, and a feeling of weight reasserts itself. Not just downward pressure like before, but the suffusion of a corporeal sense. She exists in three dimensions again. She can feel her feet, her hands, her back, and the smooth surface they're resting on.
With a nervous jolt, she woke to find herself back in a stasis booth. Through the transparent cover, she could see her friend in front of her, his arms raised in surrender as a woman pointed a gun at him.
Perry was pure instinct by now, and wrenched aside the door to the booth. The stale air of the stasis chamber rushed into her lungs.
Move, and I'll shoot you!
Perry leapt out of her booth and rocketed towards Ms. Ebo. Before the woman had a chance to think, Perry had deftly flipped her onto the ground and was busy applying a joint lock onto her wrists, forcing her to drop the gun.
The doctor blinked.
Perry? Perry! Can you hear me? He asked as Perry, as if possessed, shifted her weight and expertly pinned the taller woman to the floor.
The gun!
She shouted harshly. The doctor kicked it safely out of Amy Ebo's reach, who was fulminating into the floor.
This is assault as well as vandalism! I know my rights! Ugh, you two are going to be toast when the police get here!
The doctor was more concerned about Perry.
Perry, Just breathe and look where you are. Perry! He clicked his fingers in front of her staring eyes. Perry blinked and was relieved to find herself back in her own body at last. She smiled at the doctor, who was looking down at her with some concern. Her relief was rapidly replaced with confusion as she seemed to be kneeling on top of someone.
Doctor, where?
She began to ask, but she was cut short as Ms. Ebo shrugged her off and scrambled to her feet. Over here, Perry, said the doctor, helping her up. In the corridor outside, there was a stamping of heavy boots. Ms. Ebo smiled, and some of her previous self-assurance returned.
Right on cue. Let's see what the law makes of you.
The door to the stasis chamber opened, and a group of five officers in bulky uniforms tramped in. Ms. Ebo smirked.
Officer, arrest this pair for damage to private property, endangering the public, assault, and crimes against fashion.
Ms. Amy Bontepe Ebo?
Asked the chief officer. She nodded in reply.
I am empowered to impound this facility as former property of the liquidated company Exurus Holdings PLC.
Amy Ebo mouthed in silent incredulity.
As a former employee of the company, could you show Sergeant Clough here the accounts for this branch? Your cooperation is advised. We take economic crimes very seriously.
Ms. Ebo started to scream. The doctor and Perry burst through the doors of the TARDIS and stood panting in the control room.
Those policemen showed up at just the right time for us to escape, huh?
Wheezed Perry. The doctor chuckled and engaged the dematerialization circuits.
Oh, that was no coincidence, I assure you.
Perry frowned at him as some hazy memories started to come back to her.
Where was I before I woke up, Doctor?
Ever heard of algorithmic trading, Perry?
He didn't wait for an answer.
No, probably a bit after your time. One of the dangers of having computers run your financial systems. I sent you into the mainframe of the local stock market a little while before we arrived, and you whizzed around merrily sabotaging Exurus Holdings' share price retroactively.
Perry's head span at the memory.
So, what was I, a computer virus?
Something like that, beamed the doctor. How are you feeling now?
Okay, I guess. So, the company's been dissolved? But that means the equipment could be used again by the next person to buy it, right?
The doctor grinned and pulled a large round component out of his pocket.
They won't be able to without this, I'm afraid. A vortex phaser. Good job Miss Ebo didn't have the technical knowledge to realise what I was doing before she pulled that gun on me.
Now, where to next?
He spun on his heels and rested his hands on the TARDIS console magisterially. Perry inspected the backs of her hands, relieved once more to be, literally, comfortable in her own skin, and found herself thinking out loud.
Seems a bit harsh on her. After all, we change history all the time.
Ah, but we are professionals, aren't we? Well, I am at least.
Perry scowled at the back of his head.
Everybody hates a tourist, Perry.